for our front. Stay tuned.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 22nd, 2018. This is Up Front. I'm Brian Edwards-Teeger. Coming up on today's show, we're moments away from being joined by Mitch Jezerich to go over the latest from Washington. After 7:30 news headlines, a debate on Proposition 2. It would move money that's been restricted by a previous proposition into a pot that would let it develop supportive housing for people with mental illnesses, but at least one mental illness advocate is against it. We'll get into why. In the second hour of our program, a deep look at the relationship of Saudi Arabia to the rest of its region and U.S. interests. And finally, what a court decision about the right of Native people to get priority in Native adoptions might mean for the entire body of Native American law in this country. All that and a whole lot more coming up next after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. National Security Advisor John Bolton begins talks with top Russian officials in Moscow. The previously scheduled talks are sure to be dominated by President Trump's weekend declaration that he will pull the U.S. out of a landmark nuclear weapons treaty. Russian officials expressed dismay at Trump's announcement that the U.S. would walk away from the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Trump alleges Russia violated its terms. The treaty prohibits the U.S. and Russia from possessing, producing, or test-flying ground-launched nuclear cruise missiles with a range of 300 to 3,400 miles. Russian officials deny violations. They say U.S. withdrawal would make the world a more dangerous place. Furious reaction from transgender and other civil rights groups after the New York Times reports that reported on a Trump administration memo on gender identity. The memo says people's gender should be based on their genitalia at birth and be unchangeable. Within hours of the report, the hashtag #WeWon'tBeErased was circulating on Twitter. The Transgender Law Center sent in a statement that, quote, "We've always known this administration intends nothing short of the destruction of our communities. Here written out plain is their attempt to erase our very existence as transgender people." The Law Center said, "We won't be erased. We will fight back." Women's contraception under Obamacare is on the agenda at the Federal Appeals Court for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. At issue is a pair of new Trump administration rules that would let employers and health insurers opt out of covering women's contraception if they cite religious or moral objections. Christopher Martinez reports from Friday's court hearing.
California and four other states are suing the Trump administration's Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar over rules that would let employers opt out of providing women's contraceptive services under the Affordable Care Act. An anti-abortion group, March for Life, and a Catholic order of nuns, Little Sisters of the Poor, have joined the lawsuit on behalf of the federal administration. Sister Teresa is a nun with the Little Sisters of the Poor, a religious order that serves the elderly poor.
I stand here today to ask the court to protect our rights as religious women to live and work according to our faith.
Lawyers from both sides argued in court over whether the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court should overturn a district court's nationwide preliminary injunction blocking the new rules while the court considers the issue. Greg Baylor is a lawyer with Alliance Defending Freedom, representing the intervener defendant group March for Life.
What's at stake here is the freedom of organizations not to be forced against their conscience to provide items that they object to. March for Life is a pro-life organization, and it would be really incongruous for it to provide abortion-inducing medications through its health plan to its employees. That's what's at stake right here.
At issue is a requirement in the Affordable Care Act to include no-cost women's contraception. That was meant to reduce the gender discrimination of charging women more than men for preventive services. But it's about far more than abortion pills. Maggie Krell is a lawyer with Planned Parenthood Affiliates of California.
Any kind of birth control, any kind of contraceptive coverage requirement, any service to women that an employer could arbitrarily find against their morals.
And ultimately, it's a case that could well end up on the docket of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Christopher Martinez.
CNN is airing surveillance footage showing a man wearing Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's clothing leaving the Saudi consulate in Istanbul by the back entrance. A senior Turkish official says the video of the apparent body double indicates that Khashoggi's murder was a pre-planned killing and that efforts were made to cover it up. Saudi authorities have offered shifting explanations of Khashoggi's death after first insisting he had left the consulate. They said Khashoggi was killed in a fist fight and then that he died in a chokehold. The Saudi foreign minister appeared on Fox, where he denied that anyone close to the Saudi crown prince was involved in killing Khashoggi. He echoed an initial suggestion by President Trump that the death was a rogue operation.
There weren't people closely tied to him who were involved in this operation. There were pictures of some security officers who may have been part of his security detail from time to time, but this is normal. Security people who deal in security details rotate among different officials, both domestic and foreign. So having somebody in a picture does not imply that they're close at all. The Crown Prince has denied this. The Crown Prince is not aware of this. Even the senior leadership of our intelligence service was not aware of this. This was an operation that was a rogue operation.
The Saudi attempt to absolve the Crown Prince isn't going over with members of Congress. Nebraska Republican Senator Ben Sasse serves on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said the intelligence he has seen contradicts the Saudi explanations.
The intel that I've read is obviously not as exhaustive as the intel that the president sees. But I think the cover stories from the Saudis are a mess. You don't bring a bone saw to an accidental fist fight inside an embassy in Turkey or a consulate in Turkey. So the Saudis have said a whole bunch of crap that's not right, accurate, or true.
A top German official is pressing for a joint European Union position on Saudi Arabia after Germany backed a freeze on arms exports to the kingdom. The San Francisco Examiner reports that ride-hailing company Lyft has contributed $100,000 to the campaign against Proposition C. The hard-fought ballot measure calls for a gross receipts tax on corporate revenue of more than $50 million to fund housing and homeless services. The Examiner quoted longtime political consultant Jim Ross, who said San Francisco progressives have long looked at Lyft as the more ethical alternative to Uber. He said the contribution against Proposition C might cause them to rethink that position. The Examiner says Uber said it's not planning to jump into the fray over Proposition C. A crowd estimated at 3,000 striking Marriott hotel workers and supporters marched through the streets of San Francisco on Saturday. An estimated 8,000 housekeepers, cooks, dishwashers, and other members of Unite Here are on strike at Marriott hotels from Boston to Honolulu. They're striking for better wages, adequate health care and retirement, and safety on the job, saying one job should be enough, a reference to the fact that many hotel workers have to take second jobs to be able to support their families. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area. Patchy morning fog and clouds, then sunny and breezy. Highs in the mid-60s to lower 70s around the bay. In Fresno, in the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, 78 to 83 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news at 94.1 at 7:30.
It is just past 7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. And because it is Monday, and because he has to be here for his job anyway, it's time for Mondays with
Mitch.
It's
a very nice intro that you have, Brian. Really
morning,
perfected it. You even say it in a particular way now. Truly branded.
I've incorporated the dramatic pause.
People now know where I am on Monday.
We should build in a musical theme.
Okay. Yes.
How are you, sir?
I'm okay. Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
I spend the weekend blissfully doing things that do not involve reading the news. What fresh hell has happened in Washington?
Wow. Well, you know, not a lot's happening in Washington because Congress is at recess, so there's no congressional actions, except in one part, and that is the Senate Judiciary Committee has begun holding additional hearings for Trump's judicial nominees to join the bench, so the federal courts, before the end of the year is up, so they can be confirmed before the end of the year.
How can a committee meet while the Senate is recessed? Yeah.
So the committee can still meet, and it can meet anywhere it wants, and it actually has traveled around with only a few members that have participated in. But you will remember, Brian, if it wasn't last week, it was the week before. I don't remember what I did on Thursday or Friday, never mind last week, but I know it wasn't that long ago where we talked about the Democrats in the Senate struck a deal with Republicans to allow 15 more judicial nominations to go through in order for them to be able to have this recess before the midterm election. So that happened. Those 15 judges went through. Democrats said, well, this is going to, you know, Chuck Schumer and all of them said they were going to be confirmed regardless by the end of the year. But this allows us to get home and campaign. Well, after that occurred, there are now 50 additional judges that Senate Republicans are going to continue to try to move through before the end of this congressional session, which is pretty remarkable. 50 additional beyond the 15 that we were talking about recently. And again, this is in context of sort of reshaping the way that the federal court looks. Senate Democrats. So a couple of hearings will happen this week for two Trump appointees to join the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. These are two people that neither Kamala Harris or Dianne Feinstein back. That's a change since you got rid of the filibuster. It used to be that a president would at least confer and try to get the approval of the senators from that state. But since you don't have a filibuster or a threat of a filibuster anymore, at least needing 60 votes to be able to break a filibuster, that is now completely off the table. So they're having a couple of important hearings happening this week. Last week, hearings were also happening, confirmation hearings for these judges. Senate Democrats boycotted the hearings. They didn't even show up, but it probably won't stop them being confirmed. So we're talking potentially an extra 50 judges to be confirmed to the federal bench. And that's significant because Donald Trump had already had more of his nominees confirmed to the federal courts than any other president in the first 2 years in history. Add an additional 50, it's remarkable. So Obama, his first 2 years in office, you know, remember he had Democratic control in Congress and in the Senate. He had 60 judges approved. If Donald Trump gets these additional 50, it'll be 140 judges that will have been approved in Donald Trump's first 2 years.
The main difference being the filibuster still applied to judicial nominees during the first 2 years of Obama's
presidency. They did. But then the Senate Democrats got control again after the 2012 election of the Senate. But Republicans were filibustering Obama's nominations to the court. And then that's when Harry Reid, Senate Democratic leader, took away the filibuster for lower court judicial nominees. He kept in place the Supreme Court, the ability to filibuster a Supreme Court nominee. And, of course, Mitch McConnell changed that last year with Neil Gorsuch, more than a year ago, I guess.
Wow. That is a quiet but highly effective lock on power the Republicans are building there.
Okay. Pretty remarkable, and it also shows how important, you know, these midterm elections are.
Because
how difficult, you know, because very likely, even if the Democrats win the House of Representatives, if they don't win the Senate, you know, that's much tougher to do. You're still going to have a dynamic where Donald Trump is going to have almost a clear path towards getting his nominees confirmed by a simple majority.
And Democratic odds of taking the Senate are looking increasingly slim. Going by the state-by-state polls. Now, it's possible that there's some kind of systemic uptick in Democratic turnout that is not captured by the pollsters and not completely canceled out by vote suppression tactics in the states where there are close races that would swing every race that's close. But boy, right now, all the polling aggregation sites are putting the odds pretty low. On that depressing note...
That's right.
Let's talk about what House Republicans are talking about, even though they're not in session. Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Senate Republicans as well, and Democrats. It's interesting, and you're obviously talking about the aftermath and the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Saudi Arabian embassy in Turkey. While Donald Trump is sort of all over the place in what he says. He told the Washington Post over the weekend in a phone interview that he thought Saudi Arabia was deceiving in its information about the killing of Khashoggi. Previous to that, he said that he believed Saudi Arabia's claim that it was a rogue operation that ended up killing Khashoggi in the embassy. This also comes after, and we'll get to Congress here in a moment, but I do think it's important to note that as this story about Khashoggi has dominated the news now for the past 3 weeks, I mean, this is a long time in the Trump era for a single story to dominate the way that it is.
I can't think of any story that stayed alive that long.
Well, you know, I think the caravan, which is now back, probably was around that long back in the spring.
Because Trump kept it in the news.
Yeah, and they're going to keep this one in the news too. But that said, right there, I mean, it's pretty remarkable how much attention and sustained attention, but that's, you know, it might be happens when you kill a journalist from the Washington Post. You know, Donald Trump, you know, pretty shocking late last week in Montana praised, Republican Representative Gianfort, for body slamming, the reporter during, last spring as well. To praise an attack against a reporter while this story of Khashoggi is dominating the news is really remarkable. And you have to ask yourself, is Donald Trump, does he know what he's doing? Is he saying this purposefully? Is he sending out signals? Is he just that guy? And we all know people like this that just, they can't help it. They're going to say the wrong thing you're not supposed to say. Who knows? But that's all pretty remarkable. What I also find remarkable is what we're hearing from Congress, which so far seems to be pretty bipartisan in their condemnation of Saudi Arabia over the killing, and even calling Ben Sasse, a Republican from Nebraska, has said Congress should consider stopping the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia buys so much military gear from the United States. It's part of that relationship, along with oil. Richard Durbin, who is calling for the U.S. Ambassador, even though we don't really have an ambassador in there right now. But anyways, diplomatic personnel in Saudi Arabia to be pulled out. So you're hearing a lot of bipartisan calls about all of this. The thing is, as we mentioned, beyond the Senate Judiciary Committee, Congress is not in session.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can Congress act even if the president is unwilling to? Sure, because they can override a veto, which I've heard some lawmakers suggest that they would have the two-thirds majority needed to override a presidential veto if it meant bringing sanctions against Saudi Arabia or something like that. But I don't know. I think a lot won't be surprising. Congress's bark is oftentimes much worse than its bite, and it would not surprise me that by the time there'll be other major stories that have taken over the cycle, and this will be soon on the back, I imagine, on the back burner by the time Congress does get back into session, which will be after an election and everything.
Yeah, this would probably be a good point to mention that we will be going into depth on the geopolitics of the U.S.-Saudi relationship in the 8 o'clock hour with Dr. Imad Harb of the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. But it does look like the story is at least going to stay in the news a while longer. Turkey is going to release at least some amount of the conclusions from its own investigation into what happened inside the Saudi consulate tomorrow. That's going to spend at least a couple days working through the news cycle. We don't really know what Saudi Arabia is going to do next. Every time they revise their story about what happened, it creates like a whole new news frenzy. And even Donald Trump, I mean, it's hard to pin him down to a consistent position. One day he'll be making excuses for Mohammed bin Salman. The next day he'll be, you know, saying this is very serious. We got to do something about this.
Yeah. And the investigations are interesting. The Washington Post, in an editorial over the weekend, Jamal Khashoggi wrote for the Washington Post, called on congressional investigations into the killings. So whether that happens or not, we don't know. Again, Congress is on recess, so this is all happening. Maybe something would have happened pretty quickly if Congress wasn't on recess, but it is on recess. The intelligence committees reportedly have asked the U.S. own intelligence agencies for intercepted communications between Saudi Arabia to see if there's anything, any information they can get about the killing through that. Bob Corker, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is also asking Turkey to be provided all the video and audio that it has over his killing. So that would be something that could continue this story, sustain the story in the news if there are congressional investigations. I guess I'm just I think I think Donald Trump is probably surprised it's still in the news as mm-hmm. long as it has. I think he was thinking this would just, you know, disappear. We're not going, you know, as he's already said, we're not going to risk the weapon sales that we're already doing, the business that we're already doing over one person. And I think he was kind of coming from a real politique kind of way of looking at it. You know, Saudi Arabia killing somebody, executing somebody is not unusual. Mm-hmm. It's unusual to do it in its embassy in Turkey. That is. I don't mean to downplay the significance of that, but you know, Saudi Arabia has a horrific human rights record.
But you know, it's the story of one person with lurid details almost always has more valence in the public sphere than, you know, the killing of tens of thousands of people. And I believe Stalin had a quote about that.
Yeah.
One person, it's a murder. Kill a million, it's a statistic. I mean, I may be misattributing it. I'm probably misparaphrasing it. But someone said something like that. But also, it's like, it's a story that seems like it's made for Hollywood. The guy gets lured into an embassy. 15 Saudi intelligence agents fly in a charter jet like hours before he get there. Now there's closed circuit TV coverage, footage of them pulling up. One of them is an expert in forensic autopsies who brought a bone saw with him. They allegedly dismember the guy. And the latest news this morning is that they had someone walking around with a wig wearing matching clothes that masked Jamal Khashoggi.
A beard. Mm-hmm.
Apparently, to impersonate him in front of cameras so as to create the impression that he had actually left the embassy.
And he was wearing his clothes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I saw that video this morning. I didn't find it that convincing. He was wearing his clothes, and you do see him go to some off place area and to a public restroom, and he changes clothes back into his regular clothes. So it does give that suggestion of that's what's going on. When you meant the reason that wig, I said beard, is because it wasn't that convincing to me, because the guy actually has a full head of hair where Khashoggi did not. Mm. And it was very clear on the videotape, who was who by it. So I thought that was really sloppily done.
But every element of this is just so bizarre. I mean, I think that explains some of the valence in the media, even beyond
it is. But
the elite
but you also with the allegation that Russia killed its own former ex-intelligence folks in Europe. You know, that got a lot of attention too, and that got a, you know, that became a big deal too. And there were sort of, you know, sanctions that were passed, not major ones, but yeah.
Yeah. But also, I mean, remember the tactics Russia allegedly used, the Novichok nerve agent, or if you go back further, the radioactive isotope polonium-210. These were assassination methods that also exposed other people in the UK who had nothing to do with Russia to mortal risk.
Mm-hmm.
This would probably be a good point to remind our listeners today, for
good
all
morning,
of those
by
of
the
you
way.
Who live in California, is the last day to register to vote online. It is the last day to ask for a vote by mail ballot. The place to register to vote online is registertovote.ca.gov. That's registertovote, all one word, .ca, like California, .gov. But if you happen to miss today's deadline, it is still possible to register to vote up to and including on Election Day. They give you a form called a conditional voter registration. They give you a conditional ballot. And once they have verified your paperwork, they do count the ballot. And although in a lot of our coverage, provisional ballots and conditional ballots get bad raps because some states have very low rates of actually processing them, California's is quite high. By law, the state is required to go over and validate every ballot, even if it doesn't have a statistical chance of changing the outcome of an election. So the easiest way to make sure your paperwork is in order, if you're not already registered or if you're not sure if you're registered, go online today. Today is the deadline. Registertovote.ca.gov.
Brian, can we talk about the story in the New York Times?
Which story in the New York
concerning,
Times?
Concerning, which one? Well, concerning the Trump administration moving to try to restrict federal civil rights protections for transgendered people. Pretty important stuff there.
Yeah. So this is leaked drafts of a rule coming out of the Trump administration.
That's right.
What would the rule do?
So what the rule would do is it would redefine what gender is under Title IX. Title IX, the 1972 amendment to the Higher Education Act, that is a civil rights act really in of itself, that said that federal government or any entity that receives any money or administered by the federal government cannot discriminate based on sex and gender. And the Obama administration actually broadened what sex could be, leaving it to the ability to be able to choose gender. And what the Trump administration is now doing out of the Department of Health and Human Services is they are coming up with rule proposals that would change the definition of gender to gender will be determined by the genitalia at birth and it is immutable. In other words, it cannot change. The genitalia that you are born with, that is how the federal government for here on out, unless the rules changed again, if it does get changed in the first place, that's how the government will see you. And that's significant because what Obama did under Title IX is he then in his administration was able to extend protections against discrimination for transgendered folks in education and housing and healthcare. Again, anything that the federal government is involved in, it was not allowed to discriminate based on against transgendered folks based on that identity. And so what they're proposing again is to change that, which would basically take away standing, for transgendered folks to be able to go to a court to say they were discriminated, against, which would be pretty significant. It is a proposed rule change. It hasn't come out yet. But it is expected to come out this fall. Once it does come out, then there'll be a 60-day public comment period before it would become rule, before it would become law. And this particularly is going to affect the many aspects of government, including the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Education, the Department of Justice. Significant, again, just having the legal standing to be able to bring your case to a court. This would undo that. And then the Department of Labor as well concerning discrimination in the workforce.
But how long lasting is it? I mean, is this something the next president can reverse with the stroke of a pen?
Yes. And that's what well, not quite with the stroke of a pen, but basically.
They have to go through the whole process again,
which Trump administration is doing right now. So yes, absolutely. It's not like an act from Congress or something.
And is it possible that the rule change itself could be litigated as taking away rights that had already been vested in transgender or even, you know, intersex people? Not everybody is born with genitalia that are definitively of one sex or another.
Yeah, and I looked into that latter point. The former point, I imagine there'll be lawsuits against it. The question is, what will they claim it to? What will they attach it to? Meaning, like, how are they being violated according to what law? Mm-hmm. Before, you could say, well, because of Title IX, right? And so now with the Trump administration is trying to say, no, you don't have Title IX protection. So we'll see how that, I don't know how that ends up working out in the courts. That'd be good to talk to a lawyer about that. But as your second point, they would do DNA testing.
Again,
if there was that's I'm, well,
there's
I'm not
people born with an extra chromosome.
It. Yeah, I'm not trying to defend it.
Why now? Is this something that's just been like on the back burner, moving along in the Trump administration? We just got the first whiff of it now, or is the Trump administration intentionally leaking this out to try to gin up the evangelical base right before an election?
I'm just guessing here. Uh-huh. I think it's the latter. I think it's political. The New York Times did not write, at least in its original story, of why they were given these memos that were internal memos in the Department of Health and Human Services. But I suspect that's it. I suspect that, along with the caravan now that's in Mexico heading north, will also be something else that the Trump administration will plan on using here on out.
It's a caravan of asylum seekers who started in Honduras.
Yep. So, you know, these are the things. I think so. I mean, that's how I would guess, but I don't have definitive proof of that's what happened.
All right. Mitch Jezrich, we'll have to leave it there because we're almost out of time. Always good to see you.
Thank you, sir.
Mitch Jezrich is the host of Letters in Politics. It airs on KPFA 10 a.m. Monday through Thursday. Check it out. It is a really good show. This show is Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiger. When we come back, we're going to continue our series of ballot proposition debates, including one that has caused some amount of division in the mental health advocacy community, Proposition 2. would reallocate a whole bunch of state money from our original millionaires tax from strictly paying for mental health services to also paying for housing for people with mental disorders. Some people not so happy about having that budget cannibalized. We will talk to both sides when we come back after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. President Trump tweeted this morning the U.S. will begin cutting off or substantially reducing aid to three Central American nations over the caravan of thousands of immigrants and refugees heading to the U.S. southern border. The caravan is now in southern Mexico. Trump tweeted Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador were not able to do the job of stopping people from leaving their country and coming illegally to the U.S. The three countries received a combined total of more than $500 million in funding from the U.S. in the last fiscal year. It wasn't immediately clear how much Trump is seeking to cut. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he hopes to formally release information tomorrow on what happened to murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Turkish authorities have leaked information to the media in a steady drip, keeping the pressure on the Saudi government. A senior Turkish official says surveillance footage shows a man wearing Khashoggi's clothing, a body double, leaving the Saudi consulate in Istanbul by the back door, and that indicates his death was a pre-planned killing and that efforts were made to cover it up. Saudi officials have variously said Khashoggi died in a struggle or a chokehold. The Saudi foreign minister told Fox no one close to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved. Republican Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Bob Corker said he doesn't believe the statements attempting to absolve the Crown Prince. California has moved a step closer to allowing marijuana deliveries in communities that have banned retail sales. The proposal is a major issue that could ultimately end up in court as the state continues to set myriad rules for how pot is grown, tested, packaged, and delivered since recreational sales became legal January 1st. City officials have been able to ban retail sales within city limits, but state law says local government cannot prevent cannabis deliveries on public roads. So the three state agencies regulating marijuana have rejected the argument of opponents that marijuana deliveries would jeopardize public safety and cause other problems. The draft rules are expected to be finalized in December. Supporters say many people who need marijuana may be too ill or lack the transportation to travel long distances to buy it. Hurricane Willa has grown rapidly into an extremely dangerous near Category 5 storm in the eastern Pacific. It's on a path to smash into Mexico's western coast between Mazatlan and Puerto Vallarta by late tomorrow or early Wednesday. The governments of Sinaloa and Nayarit State ordered coastal region schools to begin closing today and began preparing emergency shelters ahead of the onslaught. The U.S. National Hurricane Center said Willa would produce life-threatening storm surge, wind, and rainfall over portions of southwestern and west-central Mexico beginning today. Weather forecast for the Bay Area, patchy morning fog and clouds, then sunny and breezy, highs in the mid-60s to lower 70s around the Bay, and Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, 78 to 83 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandary. More news on 94.1 at 8 o'clock.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
Join KPFA for a very special Halloween movie matinee on Saturday, October 27th at 3 p.m. for a screening of the film that launched the modern zombie movie craze, the original Night of the Living Dead. The horror classic in which several people barricade themselves inside a house in an attempt to survive the night from hordes of zombies. There will be a costume contest for Best Dressed Zombie to win delectable food and monstrous prizes. Join us for an afternoon of fun, thrills, and chills on Saturday, October 27th at 3 p.m. at your own risk. For more information, visit kpfa.org or thenewparkway.com.
It is 7:34 in the morning here at Spooky KPFA. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tika. We're continuing our series of ballot debates, moving on to California State Proposition 2. This is an initiative that would take a large pot of money initially created by voters by approving a tax on people with extraordinarily high incomes to pay for mental health services and giving permission from the voters to take enough money out of that pot to finance $2 billion in affordable housing bonds for people with mental illness. This is something that has created a certain amount of controversy within the mental health advocacy community. Because the money is needed for both services and housing, not everyone wants those two to be in competition. We're going to have both sides on. Joining us on the pro side, Deborah Anderloo. She is communications director with the Steinberg Institute, which works on brain health issues. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you, Brian.
And on the con side, Gigi Crowder, executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Contra Costa County chapter. Her chapter is opposing Proposition 2. I want to be clear, though, the statewide NAMI organization is for it. Gigi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Deborah, because you're in the affirmative, we'll start with you. Why Prop 2? Why should the voters move this money around?
Well, thank you. And first, I want to be clear, but along with statewide NAMI, the statewide Mental Health America supports this. Doctors groups, the emergency doctors, pretty much every mental health provider and advocacy group in the state. There has been actually very, very little opposition to this. The idea behind it, again, when Prop 63, the millionaire's tax you mentioned, when it was passed in 2004, the idea was to strengthen mental health services throughout California. And a big intention at the time was, in fact, to affect the huge population of people who were on the streets and homeless because they are mentally ill. We know that of the 134,000 Californians who are homeless, about a third of them are there because they are mentally ill, which is really just a shocking thing to have to say, you know, that because you have an illness or a disease, you end up on the streets. We wouldn't say that for cancer or so many other illnesses. But here, this many years later, we feel like as much good as the proposition has done, as many people as, you know, have been helped, that homelessness still is a huge issue, and in fact, probably in most communities in California, people would say it is the biggest quality of life issue. So what Prop 2 does is it takes a very small percentage of this Prop 63 money. It would take about $120 million a year over 30 years, and this is a pot of money, by the way, that generates $2.2 billion a year. So it takes a very small percentage to leverage a huge infusion of money up front, a $2 billion bond, so that we could create housing linked to services using a model of treatment and housing that we know actually has been proven to work over the years for people who are living homeless with mental illness. So the idea here is that on their own, for this population, services alone don't work. You really need services tied to housing, or you're not spending that money well. So this would make sure that across the state, counties have a huge infusion of funds to build the housing they need to make these services effective.
Gigi Crowder, sounds reasonable. Why are you against it?
We're against it, and I would ask any of the individuals who were surveyed who are backing this initiative one question. Are you a primary caregiver for a person who lives with a severe mental illness? Are you in a position to offer more than an opinion, or do you have facts to back up the fact that individuals should be using what has been proposed, a housing first model? Individuals that live with severe mental illnesses, whether they're on the streets, homeless, unfortunately, and dealing with additional concerns like substance abuse, are not. It is a very debilitating illness, which many of us who are family members, especially here in Contra Costa County, have tried to find housing solutions for our loved ones. Some individuals have taken out second mortgages on their own home, thinking, well, my loved one cannot live with me, but I do want them to have stable, secure, and safe housing. So let me try putting them in their own place. And it has, for a lot of individuals, ended in tragic results because there are skill sets that need to be in place. The idea that you would take someone who lived on the streets and put them into a housing situation without the treatment and wraparound services, it baffled me that someone obviously doesn't understand the debilitating components of a mental illness. So family members get it. And that's why family members, those that I represent, my own belief system as well, having worked in the mental health field hands-on directly, having helped individuals find secure housing, Section 8 vouchers so they could live alone, have learned hard lessons about what needs to take place first. Now, some of what is promising has been some of the full-service partnerships, some of the things that if you take away the treatment dollars, we'll have less resources to do. I don't understand why this needs to be a statewide initiative when locally counties can use now the Mental Health Services Act dollars and decide what type of housing is most needed. Sadly, some individuals need very supervised housing. They need to be reminded to take their psychiatric medication. So the groups that have been mentioned in support of this, I'd like to know how many of them really have firsthand experience, not a family member who gets a phone call when their sister's son is not doing well, but when they get the call themselves, because that's a very different voice than the voice that I've been hearing for the folks that are for it. They do not understand. And we're in a club in Contra Costa County. None of us wanted to be a part of it. We were drafted into it, but we love our loved ones and we want what's best for them. And we know the treatment, the appropriate treatment services, stability, housing that supports individuals is what's needed most, not taking away the dollars because some counties didn't do necessarily what they should have done with that and had them the money still sitting there waiting.
All right, Gigi Kreider, I think we got your points. Let's put them to Deborah Anderlew for a response. The first one was the point that housing without adequate supportive services and care connected to the housing would not be useful for people with mental disorders. Deborah Anderlew?
Thanks, Brian. First of all, we're talking about housing that is absolutely linked to services. In fact, for counties to get this money, they have to commit to providing services for the units created for at least 20 years. We're also talking about a model, and I could, I've looked at the research myself. This has been years and years of research throughout the country. It's a model called permanent supportive housing. It has absolutely been shown to be more effective than transitional housing, shelters, all sorts of things for getting people into treatment and keeping them off the streets. And in fact, RAND just released a study along these lines looking at what Los Angeles County has already done along these lines, and they found that in just a few years they were able to move 3,500 people off the streets, and it saved the county 20% in costs because these are people who, if they weren't in these programs, end up cycling through our jails, through our emergency rooms. We've all been there. We've all seen them. And to her second point, I would say the groups we're talking about who support this are the upfront providers. These are the people who are either have family members or live with mental illness or who work with people on the streets. And if I understand it correctly, I mean, there's a certain percentage of people with serious mental illness who are not able to live on their own. They need to live in sort of an involuntary situation. This is not that. This is for people who can be moved into housing and can take part in wraparound services, but it's not an institution per se. The thinking here and counties across the state, every single county has already applied for funds. So these are the providers who are working with people who think they need this money, that this will improve treatment, and that it will help tens of thousands of people. For people who need involuntary commitment, which is maybe what Gigi's talking about.
Well, let's not speculate what she's talking about. We'll pass the microphone back to Gigi Crowder. Gigi, I want to get specific. It sounds like you personally provide care for somebody in your life. What are you afraid you will lose access to if Proposition 2 passes?
One of the things that family members recognize, that others who are making this decision without input from the family members who
don't talk about the process. Just tell me what you're worried will happen.
I have seen and heard stories since my name is listed in the ballot for individuals to call me. I've heard family members calling, being very appreciative of the fact that I get, and our affiliate gets, the fact that
I'm sorry, Gigi, I'm trying to pin down the specifics of your argument here. What are you specifically afraid you'll lose?
We would lose the treatment dollars that could help us have more programs. So there's a difference between a person who lives with a mental illness and a person who lives with a severe mental illness, which is a severe mental illness is the individuals you would find homeless. Those are the people who have persistent severe mental illnesses. So it's not a small percentage of individuals who would possibly lose their gain benefit from this. Our family members have loved ones who sometimes are in compliance with the medications, seeing their therapist, and the symptoms just don't go away because they want them to go away. They're there. The nature of the illness is I've had people who lived in the best supported independent living situation, but because of the nature of the illness, have decompensated.
Right, but so you're afraid that you're going to lose, like, caregiver reimbursement from the state? You're afraid you're going to lose medical services? What?
I have seen counties not do these programs in a manner consistent with producing the best outcomes for the individuals, even when housing is included. I've seen them put individuals in the housing and then not show up often enough to be able to support them and make sure they're taking their medications. I think we're losing board and care type facilities, and funding for those type of situations should be made available.
Okay, let's put that to Deborah Anderloo. Is this going to be in competition with funding for board and care facilities?
No. Again, a big part of this is to infuse money up front, you know, much like you would with a mortgage when you're buying a house, or much as California has tackled other crises, that we're going to leverage money so that we can get this $2 billion, in money up front rather than for a specific kind of housing. And that money in turn, by the way, communities are expected to leverage it maybe 10 times more using federal funding and tax credits, et cetera. So this will be in addition to what communities already offer. And also,
well, the money is coming from somewhere. There's an opportunity cost to pulling $140 million annually out of whatever's already being spent on to finance the bonds that would pay for this housing. So what's it going to come away from? What's going to go away for the sake of building this housing?
Well, for example, that's money that maybe now is going into housing, but you now get to leverage it to a much greater extent. And we also know that some counties have had difficulty, knowing exactly how to spend all of their funds. You know, we've all read and talked about that. And so this funding is there. Counties don't seem to be concerned that they're going to have to cut services, to people, because this is again generating money up front that they can leverage. And again, it has to be.
But it's $140 million out of the budget. It's $140 million going to building physical things. I mean, that's going to come away from services, isn't it?
Well, it's going to make the services work. You know, one could argue that without the housing, these services are not effective.
Okay, Gigi Crowder, let's take that question up. I, in the course of reporting, speak to a lot of homeless people here in the Inner East Bay. A lot of them do have mental disorders, and a lot of them say that being on the streets makes them much, much harder to manage, harder to stay on a medication schedule, harder to stay in touch with medical care providers. And just like the unpredictability of sleep, the stress and vulnerability that comes from sleeping on the street, I think might make a lot of us start displaying symptoms of mental disorders. Isn't housing a good treatment for people in that situation?
I definitely agree that no one wants to see anyone homeless. But this housing crisis that we're in, some of it was created with the fact that the county did not know how best to approach addressing housing under the Mental Health Services Act. So what wound up happening is a lot of individuals would drop in and out of services because of the poor planning on the behalf of the counties. That's just the reality. And so for me, looking at, let's just take Los Angeles for an example. We all widely recognize that it houses the most individuals with mental illness in their criminal justice system. So if you're not looking at root causes and how individuals end up incarcerated because they have a severe mental illness and they make bad decisions because they're not being treated. And for me, as an African-American, the bulk of those individuals wind up being African-American and homeless. Why take the money from treatment services? Many of us Americans who are homeowners, Californians, would be willing to have a tax around our property, a tax around our income, a tax around sales, because this homelessness issue is affecting all of us. Why would we try and solve the problem with the limited amount of dollars that we get from Mental Health Services Act? In most counties, when Mental Health Services Act was passed in 2004, it was supposed to be the cherry on top. It was supposed to be the extra, whatever it takes dollars. It has become the core funding for a lot of counties.
Okay, let's put that question to Deborah Anderlew. That's a fair question. I assume you were involved in the conversation that led to this getting on the ballot in its present form. Why cannibalize an existing stream of funding? Why not ask voters to pay extra for housing people with mental disorders?
Two things. You mentioned I'm the communications director for the Steinberg Institute, and that was founded by Daryl Steinberg, who is now mayor of Sacramento, but he was a longtime legislator and was president of the state Senate, and he, in fact, authored the Mental Health Services Act, Prop 63, and he would tell you, if he were on this call, that it was absolutely his intention that this would impact mentally ill people who are living homeless. One of the things that happened, I think, after Prop 63 happened, is again this model, permanent supportive housing, was very clearly rose to the top as a model that works for getting people with mental illness off the streets and getting them into recovery. But as Gigi said, not every county was doing it. So the idea of taking this to the ballot was to create an incentive so that we scale up statewide a model that we know is effective and that will have a huge impact in getting thousands of people off the street.
Right, so, but you could have gone straight to the ballot with a $2 billion bond above and beyond the funding that already existed to pay for this type of housing and create the exact same incentives for counties. Did it just poll differently? Did you think it wasn't politically feasible to do that?
I was not in on those kinds of conversations, but I think this didn't just suddenly go to the ballot. This was a law 2 years ago where Kevin DeLeon and the legislature approved a law thinking we've got a big pot of money here. And it was intended to help people who are homeless and mentally ill get off the streets. Let's make sure counties are scaling up this effective model. So there was a law that was passed. It was signed by the governor. And then subsequently, there was legal action that has held it up in courts. So what Proposition 2 does is says it goes back to the voters, and we believe the voters are going to say, yes, we think this is an appropriate use of this $2.2 billion a year that we're getting in mental health services funds. We do think it should be housing. It should be funding permanent supportive housing, so housing linked to services that will helped impact our homeless problem.
All right, that's Deborah Anderlus. She is arguing in favor of Proposition 2. Proposition 2 would reallocate some of the money created for mental health services by California's original millionaire's tax to fund housing bonds to create supportive housing for people with mental disorders in the state of California. Since we give Deborah the first word in this debate, Gigi Crowder, we will give you the last for the con side. Go ahead.
I am working with a faith center in Alameda County who's had housing available associated with their church. They had extra space. There's been a lot of gentrification in Oakland, so a lot of individuals have moved out. It was brought to me by a staff person in our Alameda County Behavioral Health Care when I worked there to move this effort. It's sitting vacant, and this is a facility that's willing to support individuals with mental illness. The counties do not necessarily have the skill set to move things forward. It gets caught in bureaucracy over and over again. And in this particular community, they're not even dealing with NIMBYism. They got the support from the community, and we're 3 years waiting to see when the county will release the funds so that this pastor can, having listened to the community, would open up that space. Another thing about NIMBYism is in Walnut Creek, in the county that I'm representing, 600 residents decided that they do not want a residential treatment facility with 13 beds in their community. So NIMBYism wasn't even addressed. Lots of times by the time the housing is built, there's so many conditional use permits that individuals with the most severe mental illnesses, with criminal backgrounds who may have had arson, they're not even the individuals who could get into the housing. So what you wind up doing is you wind up creaming, and you don't get who your intended population was going to be in the first place. I've seen that happen over and over again. And I'm just hoping that maybe the Durell Steinberg Institute will step up and start addressing the many people who are criminalized for having a mental illness, so who are in jail instead of being housed in treatment programs. I don't want any dollars to be taken away from treatment as long as I know there's individuals with being criminalized for having a medical condition.
All right. That's the voice of Gigi Crowder. She's executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Contra Costa County chapter. Her chapter is opposing Proposition 2, as I said earlier, and I'll repeat it so there's no confusion. The statewide National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI organization, is supporting Proposition 2. On the pro side, we had Deborah Anderlew. She is communications director with the Steinberg Institute, which works on brain health issues. Thanks, both of you, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that takes us to 7:57 in the morning. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Teeger. Before we move on with the program, a quick look at what's happening on the stage. Here's Richard Walensky.
How does misunderstanding and misapprehension change and distort our relationships? The smallest things, a casual comment and a strange look, start to take the wheels off in the fascinating new play, You Mean to Do Me Harm, by Christopher Chen, at San Francisco Playhouse through November 3rd. Bill English, artistic director of San Francisco Playhouse and director of this production.
Well, it's two interracial couples, Asian, Anglo-American. They gather for a dinner party, and there's a misunderstanding that occurs at the dinner party that throws the four of them into a kind of Walpurgisnacht of self-examination and stress in the individual relationships.
On the surface, the play's theme comes through loud and clear and is related to the characters and what they do on stage.
I think microaggression is the primary theme, in the sense that people of color that grow up in this country who may have some background, some ties to their country of origin, but they're basically living in this world as Americans, but there's a difficulty finding trust in terms of what they hear. And it's difficult to separate your own tendency to be paranoid.
You Mean to Do Me Harm is about many things. It's also about China and its relationship to America. It's about the nature of war and how wars start. It's about the often prickly relationship between men and women in business and power struggles between genders in marriage. And it's also about racism, In fact, because these subtexts go on and on, it almost feels as if the play is about too many things. Playwright Christopher Chen doesn't help when he adds that this is, in his words, a minimalist fable that upends convention by removing all explicit markers of time and place, so that the discussions are presented in a disarmingly uprooted context. Thus, the abstract stage, the shifts in space and time that are sometimes disorienting. The production, though, keeps centered in the strong performances of the two couples. The conflicts on stage feel real, as does the chemistry. It could be argued that if, as the playwright says, you've uprooted all the contextual markers from a work of art, there may no longer be anything to grasp, to hold. There is that, and it's a bit unnerving. On the other hand, should any artistic endeavor be faulted for biting off a little more than it can chew? You Mean to Do Me Harm by Christopher Chen, directed by Bill English, plays at San Francisco Playhouse through November 3rd. For more information, you can go to sfplayhouse.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Bay Area Theater for KPFA.
That takes us just past 8 o'clock in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online around the world at www.kpfa.org. The program is up front. My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert. Coming up in the program, we're going to take a look at the geopolitics of the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia and try to disentangle all the interests that are the subtext of the sparring that's happening in the public sphere over what repercussions there should be for the apparent killing and dismemberment of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. In the second half of next hour, we're going to look into a recent court ruling that dealt a blow to the Indian Child Welfare Act and what the broader implications are for the body of law that establishes and protects native sovereignty in this country. Stay tuned for all of that coming up next after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News headlines. National Security Advisor John Bolton began talks with top Russian officials in Moscow. The previously scheduled talks are sure to be dominated by President Trump's weekend declaration that he would pull the U.S. out of a landmark nuclear weapons treaty. Russian officials expressed dismay at Trump's announcement that the U.S. would walk away from the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Trump alleges Russia violated its terms. Daryl Kimball, director of the Arms Control Association, appeared on Democracy Now!, where he said Bolton is behind Trump's move.
This appears to be a John Bolton-inspired decision by Donald Trump to pull out of this very important agreement, which has eliminated, as you said, an entire class of intermediate-range missiles that once threatened Europe. 2,692 U.S. and Soviet missiles were verifiably eliminated as a result of this treaty.
The Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty prohibits the U.S. and Russia from possessing, producing, or test flying ground-launched nuclear cruise missiles with a range of 300 to 3,400 miles. Russian officials deny violations. They said the U.S. withdrawal will make the world a more dangerous place. Furious reaction from transgender and other civil rights groups after the New York Times reported that a Trump administration memo on reported on a Trump administration memo on gender identity. The memo says people's gender should be based on their genitalia at birth and be unchangeable. Within hours of the report, the hashtag won't be erased was circulating on Twitter. The Transgender Law Center sent in a statement that, quote, we've always known this administration intends nothing short of the destruction of our communities. Here, written out plain, is their attempt to erase our very existence as transgender people. The Law Center said, we won't be erased. We will fight back. San Francisco State Senator Scott Wiener said the memo was consistent with what he called the administration's effort to erase LGBT people from health surveys and the census. He said the consequences of the policy would be more trans children committing suicide and more trans people assaulted and murdered. Wiener added, quote, we won't go away. He vowed that California will continue to fully embrace transgender and LGBT people. Uruguay's Congress has approved a new law that guarantees rights to the South American country's transgender community. The law grants transgender people the right to have gender reassignment surgery and hormone treatments paid for by the state. It mandates that 1% of government jobs be reserved for transgender people and establishes a pension to compensate transgender people who were persecuted during Uruguay's military dictatorship in the 1970s and 80s. CNN is airing surveillance footage showing a man wearing Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's clothing leaving the Saudi consulate in Istanbul by the back entrance. A senior Turkish official said the video of the apparent body double indicates Khashoggi's murder was a pre-planned killing and that efforts were made to cover it up. Saudi authorities have offered shifting explanations of Khashoggi's death after first insisting that he had left the consulate alive. This weekend, they said Khashoggi was killed in a fistfight with Saudi officials and then that he died in a chokehold. The Saudi foreign minister appeared on Fox News, where he denied that anyone close to the Saudi crown prince was involved in killing Khashoggi. He echoed an initial suggestion by President Trump that it was a rogue operation.
There weren't people closely tied to him who were involved in this operation. There were pictures of some security officers who may have been part of his security detail from time to time, but this is normal. Security people who deal in security details rotate among different officials, both domestic and foreign. So having somebody in a picture does not imply that they're close at all. The Crown Prince has denied this. The Crown Prince is not aware of this. Even the senior leadership of our intelligence service was not aware of this. This was an operation that was a rogue operation.
Republican Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Bob Corker said he doesn't believe the statements attempting to absolve the Crown Prince.
Obviously, if he's gone forth and murdered this journalist, he's now crossed the line, and there has to be a punishment and a price paid for that. And again, I'm not rushing to judgment. Do I think he did it? Yes, I think he did it. Let's finish this investigation.
Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin called for the expulsion of Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S.
We ought to formally expel the Saudi ambassador from the United States until there is a completion of a third-party investigation into this kidnap, murder, and God knows what followed that occurred in Istanbul. We should call on our allies to do the same. Unless the Saudi kingdom understands that civilized countries around the world are going to reject this conduct and make sure that they pay a price for it, they'll continue doing it.
A top German official is pressing for a joint European Union position on Saudi Arabia after Germany backed a freeze on arms exports to the kingdom. The San Francisco Examiner reports that ride-hailing company Lyft has contributed $100,000 to the campaign against Proposition C. The hard-fought ballot measure calls for a gross receipts tax on corporate revenue of more than $50 million to fund housing and homeless services. The Examiner quoted longtime political consultant Jim Ross, who said San Francisco progressives have long looked at Lyft as the more ethical alternative to Uber. He said the contribution against Prop C might cause them to rethink that position. The Examiner says Uber told it that it's not planning to jump into the fray over Proposition C. Salesforce Chief Mark Benioff has become the highest profile tech leader in San Francisco to support the measure. He said he'll spend $2 million to help pass it. The head of Twitter is opposing Prop C. He told the New York Times he'll contribute $75,000 to the campaign against it. The Examiner reports that tech company Stripe will spend $400,000 to oppose Proposition C. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, patchy morning fog and clouds, then sunny and breezy. Highs in the mid-60s to lower 70s around the bay. In Fresno in the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, 78 to 83 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news on 94.1 at 8:30.
It is just past 8:08 in the morning. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. We're going to pick up this with the developing story of what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. The Saudi government now confirming that he was killed, in their consulate. Their narrative has shifted from he walked out under his own power to he was killed by their agents, but after a fight broke out between him and 15 people working for the state of Saudi Arabia. this has not done anything to deter extremely strong criticism and calls for action coming from members of Congress. And the next advancement in the story seems to be what will happen tomorrow when Turkey releases the results of its own probe into the killing, which seems to be based on some form of surveillance inside the Saudi consulate. I thought this would be a good time to pull back the focus and kind of disentangle the regional and geopolitical interests that are behind the standoff over what happened to one journalist inside the consulate. We're joined now by Imad Harb. He is Director of Research and Analysis at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. I believe we have him on Skype. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Hi, Brian.
Let's start with the latest Saudi account. It is both that Khashoggi was killed, that it was accidental, and that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince and de facto ruler of the country, had nothing to do with it. Do you buy it?
No. Simply no, I do not buy it. There have been a lot of explanations that none of them actually makes any sense. These people in a centralized state like Saudi Arabia, and where decision-making is basically only in the royal court, for these people to go rogue and do whatever they want to do is simply not credible. And the stories that have surfaced since then make it really even less credible than anything. I mean, you know, the old adage says, you know, if you're in a hole, stop digging. Apparently, they're not going to stop digging.
Yeah. Most of the counter-narrative thus far has come from news articles that are citing anonymous Turkish intelligence sources, and we're going to see Turkish intelligence go on the record tomorrow, presumably,
right,
when they release the results of their probe. What are Turkey's interests in this? What is the Turkish-Saudi Arabian relationship like?
You know, Turkey has for a long, long time tried to really steer clear of antagonizing Saudi Arabia. They do not want to antagonize Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia is, you know, it's the religious center of the Islamic world. And also Saudi Arabia is the source of a whole lot of funding that can come to Turkey for investments. So they have avoided any problems with the Saudis, despite the fact that since last year, Turkey has been really on the hot seat regarding Saudi Arabia because of the Gulf crisis, the thing that's involving the state of Qatar. But at any rate, the Turks now are, to me, they are in a bind. I mean, do they tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Or do they just hide some things that they consider to be to negatively affect their relations, further negatively affect their relations with Saudi Arabia? Tomorrow's announcement.
But I'm sorry, it seems like if Turkey wanted to do things by the book, they would have kept mum until they finished their investigation. The fact that there were multiple leaks from inside their intelligence, doesn't that suggest that Turkey saw some advantage in discrediting Saudi Arabia, doing it early?
Of course, there are advantages, and Turkey is going to exploit those advantages. The issue is, we also have to remember that, you know, Turkey is not only one person, is not only one institution. Each institution is trying to make itself be the one on the right side of history, so to speak. Tomorrow, the Turkish president, announces what the result of the investigations have revealed. But then again, is he really truly going to announce everything, to say everything? What has been leaked so far is rather detailed. I mean, these people have cameras everywhere. I mean, it appears like everybody is caught on camera doing something. So I am sure the Turks have a lot of facts, if not everything, but definitely a whole lot of facts that shed great light on this. But then again, really, we can't really discount the fact that Turkey may exploit this for its own messaging anyway. But in the end, truth has to come out. And in the end, Turkey is going to release that truth that really does not necessarily break relations with Saudi Arabia, but yet tells the truth at least partially.
I mean, both Turkey and Saudi Arabia are regional powers in the Middle East.
Right.
They both project force beyond their borders. If the United States Congress springs into action and announces some kind of sanctions against the Saudi government, does Turkey benefit from that?
Well, Turkey, I think Turkey is trying to get an American angle from this whole thing. They got the American angle by releasing Mr. Brunson, and on that angle, they got President Trump to leave them alone for a little while. So, but if Congress actually really leaps into action and starts asking really probing questions of the Saudis and trying to pressure Saudi Arabia to release more information about this, Turkey is not going to be unhappy with that. Then it becomes, as far as Turkey is concerned, it's a U.S.-Saudi thing. We have nothing to do with it. But on the other hand, I think Turkey will egg Congress on, would like Congress to really do the job for it and try to push for release of information.
Let's talk about what's happening inside Saudi Arabia. So the person in the crosshairs here is the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Yeah. He's the de facto ruler. The nominal ruler is his father, King Salman.
Right.
And the response so far has been to say Mohammed bin Salman was in the dark about what happened, and to further consolidate his power. His father has put him in charge of overhauling the intelligence agencies, because the Saudi narrative is they went rogue in this instance. I guess my question is kind of what is the practical consequence for the region of Mohammed bin Salman's already fairly consolidated power being further consolidated? What does he represent in terms of regional policy?
Well, for one thing, he is, like you say, he is the ruler of Saudi Arabia, the actual person who's making day-to-day decisions. I want to back up a little bit. You know, those sure. people who are accused supposedly of doing this rogue operation, these are his people. These are his very, very people. So for him to restructure the intelligence agencies to bring better people there, I mean, these were his people. I mean, he's getting rid of his own people to get better people. I just don't get it. The issue is it's a very, very hard sell for them to sell this, to sell it this way.
So you think it's a pure face-saving maneuver? It's not about reorganizing
exactly.
the bureaucracy
and you know, Mohammed bin Salman has a lot of influence, definitely regionally. He has a lot of influence, but there are a lot of things that he can do to just make himself a little more acceptable, not only to Saudis who are opposed to his policies, but also to the region, to the regional states that are really suffering from some decisions that he has taken. The Qatar issue of June of 2017, when Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Bahrain, together with Egypt, imposed a blockade, and they actually isolated Qatar from the rest of the world, supposedly because Qatar is not doing the right thing. The other thing is the war in Yemen. The war in Yemen is a devastating war that has killed, United Nations stopped counting, I think, like 2.5-3 years ago. And at that time, it was 10,000 people who had died in that war. And now, Yemen basically is on the verge of the greatest humanitarian disaster in the 21st century. 20 people are in danger of actually starving to death. And the country is under siege. It can't import anything. It can't export anything because Saudi warplanes are in the air all the time. So all these are decisions that Mohammed bin Salman himself took. So although he has a lot of friends in the area, he also has a lot of other people who are saying that he's not doing the right thing. So for the United States to not to interfere in this and try to put a stop to what this person is doing to Saudi Arabia and to U.S. relations and to Saudi Arabian relations with its neighbors. I think the Trump administration needs to get on and start doing the right thing.
So if he ordered the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, what do you think he thought he would get out of it? How would that work to his advantage?
Well, for one thing, he had Jamal Khashoggi may he rest in peace, is one in a series of a whole bunch of people who have been killed or have been disappeared in prisons or anywhere over the last, 10, 15 years. There has been, Mohammed bin Salman is not the first, and unfortunately he may not be the last, who really has this issue with absolute rulership and absolute control. What he gets out of it is he silences yet another voice that is supposedly that was telling the truth about what Mohammed bin Salman's projects for the kingdom, the future of the kingdom, rests upon what Mohammed bin Salman decides economically, politically, socially, militarily, whatever. Jamal Khashoggi was basically bringing the truth to the world about what it really means to have these projects. You know, nobody is criticizing Saudi Arabia for trying to diversify its economy. Nobody is criticizing Saudi Arabia for trying to assure its regional security and peace. The problem is, how are you doing this? Jamal Khashoggi died because he put some blame on Mohammed bin Salman for not doing the right thing by the country. What he gets out of it is, again, like I said, he silences yet another voice that is criticizing these really harebrained plans, whether economically, socially, or politically, that Mohammed bin Salman has been trying to carry on for the last few years.
Right, but up till this point, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, had very effectively gotten most of the Western media to frame him as little more than a liberal reformer inside Saudi Arabia, and kind of erase everything else that you talked about, not to describe him as a tyrant consolidating power within Saudi Arabia, and certainly not to spend much time on the war he's prosecuting in Yemen. This seems to be like the first major public relations disaster for Mohammed bin Salman. Do you think he just thought killing a Washington Post journalist wouldn't draw this kind of attention?
I have a feeling that he simply did not think that will draw this much attention. As far as he is concerned, you have to also remember, this person has only come on the scene over the last 3 years, 3.5 years. He had no political experience as far as knowing what the world is about and all this. So as far as I'm concerned, it's a lot of hubris. It's he thinks that whatever he does is going to be bought by the international community, especially by Washington. And unfortunately, American journalists have really fallen for this thing about, he's a reformer, he's he let women drive. I mean, big deal. I mean, this is their right. Why would he? Why should they wait for somebody to let them drive? I mean, it's absurd. For American journalists, or actually some other Western journalists and European journalists who actually fell for this, that this is great. This is, he's reforming the society. He's reforming this. He's reforming that. A lot of people in the United States were surprisingly so sold on this agenda of liberalization. That they actually forgot that this person really doesn't know what he's doing, to tell the honest truth. And now all the chickens have come home, and now we don't know what the future of Saudi Arabia is going to be like because of this man. So this is the thing, American journalists have been complicit. American journalists have covered up for a lot of the abuses that he and people like him and before him, there are other people, from the Philippines to Egypt to Pakistan to a whole bunch of other places that American journalists have somehow been sold on as these are reformers, they're trying to change the old way and stuff like that. But yet again, these are people who are doing this in the service of their own personal interests, in the service of making themselves even more autocratic.
Walk me through the things that could potentially happen next. Let's take a worst case scenario for Saudi Arabia, which is that the United States leads the charge on imposing sanctions. First of all, are the United States, the international community, capable of blocking Saudi oil exports?
Well, this is a huge thing. It's really a huge thing for the United States, for instance, to think about. You know, I heard in your little segment before the interview about you know, people are basically. I think was it Richard Durbin who asked for the ambassador to be recalled or something? And you know, it's very, very tough. This is a very extremely delicate kind of situation. Saudi Arabia is a major provider of the world energy, and on a daily basis. And any problem with that is going to really hit the international economy very hard. Yet again, do we let Saudi Arabia do all that it's doing, whether it's the war in Yemen, whether it is the killing of free-minded journalists? Should we let that happen? I don't think that the United States or the world, for that matter, should let things like this happen, or should, you know, let Saudi Arabia go scot-free. But then again, you know, how do you impose certain kind of restrictions on Saudi behavior if you do not want to affect the international economy in that sense? You know, back in 1973, Saudi Arabia had, you know, it cut off all oil supplies. All the Arab countries have cut off oil supplies and caused an international bad situation. So, but now Saudi Arabia is not capable of doing that anyway. I mean, Saudi economy is way too dependent on the international economy to cut off supplies of oil and things like that. So I think the answer lies in Saudi Arabia itself. I think the pressure should be on Saudi Arabia itself to try to change domestically. And if possible, for the President Trump, to try to show the Saudi leadership that the United States is not going to stand for things like that. And definitely radical changes within the Saudi political system need to take place.
Right, but what would that mean? I mean, if the U.S. can't afford to block Saudi oil exports, and Saudi Arabia can't afford to shut off Saudi oil exports to retaliate against sanctions, like who has leverage and to do what?
This is the thing. This is, after all, I mean, this is Saudi sovereignty, right? We're not going to invade Saudi Arabia to impose a certain regime on it. But yet, at the same time, there are subtle ways of making your message heard. We could at least, first of all, I mean, appoint an ambassador in Riyadh to try to get our message there. I think King Salman himself can be approached to try to limit the powers of Mohammed bin Salman, what's in his hand so far. I don't think that the king is actually cognizant of all the things that Mohammed bin Salman has been doing, or has, you know, the calamities that he has really caused inside the kingdom or in the region. So I think the Trump administration has a responsibility to try to go to Riyadh and try to show the king what is happening. This is why tomorrow's announcement by the Turks, who knows, maybe it will bring some added pressure. It will give the world community, or even King Salman himself, something to go with. You know, at the same time, we also have to remember that this is always been. Saudi Arabia did not want anybody to interfere in its domestic affairs. And these are the affairs not only of Saudi Arabia, these are the affairs of the royal family, the Saudi royal family itself. So it's a very extremely complicated issue, but the United States and the international community cannot just leave it at that. There has to be some.
I guess I don't understand why diplomatic persuasion would change anything absent actual leverage, you know, a threat of action that would have adverse consequences for the Saudi regime.
Well, there's always the action of a threat of cutting off military aid. you know, you can always threaten to cut off the trade. You know, Senator Bernie Sanders and a whole bunch of people with him, both Republicans and Democrats, are calling for at least a halt in American weapons deliveries regarding the war in Yemen. So this can send a very, very big message. Question is, will the American military be ready to do something like this? Will it be happy to do something like this? We know that Secretary Mattis is not on board. You know, he wants to continue the relationship with Saudi Arabia and all that. But yet again, I mean, you know, how much is the United States? How much is the United States system, whether it's military, political, Congress, or CASCA? How much can they keep taking from these transgressions regarding the war in Yemen? I think this is a very good step as far as I'm concerned. Maybe that can get a message across.
All right. Ahmad Harb, we'll have to leave it there because that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
I thank you.
Ahmad Harb is Director of Research and Analysis at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. Coming up on 8:30 in the morning, the program's Up Front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. Coming up, we're going to talk about how a court decision that dealt a blow to the Indian Child Welfare Act could have much broader reaching implications for everything from the rights of tribes to operate casinos to have sovereignty over the use of natural resources that are on their lands. Then we're going to take a look at the legacy of child separation for Native Americans and some of the tentative truth and reconciliation processes that are taking place today. That's both coming up next after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he hopes to formally release information tomorrow on what happened to murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Turkish officials have leaked information to the media in a steady drip, keeping the pressure on the Saudi government. A senior Turkish official says surveillance footage showing a man, a body double, wearing Khashoggi's clothes, leaving the Saudi consulate in Istanbul by the back door, indicates his death was a pre-planned killing and that efforts were made to cover it up. Saudi officials have variously said since the weekend that Khashoggi died in a struggle or a chokehold. The Saudi foreign minister told Fox no one close to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved. Nebraska Republican Senator Ben Saf serves on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said the intelligence he has seen contradicts the Saudi explanations.
The intel that I've read is obviously not as exhaustive as the intel that the president sees. But I think the cover stories from the Saudis are a mess. You don't bring a bone saw to an accidental fist fight inside an embassy in Turkey or a consulate in Turkey. So the Saudis have said a whole bunch of crap that's not right, accurate, or true.
Indonesia's president told the Saudi foreign minister he's deeply concerned about Khashoggi's killing and wants a transparent investigation. President Trump tweets this morning that the U.S. will begin cutting off or substantially reducing aid to three Central American nations over a caravan of thousands of immigrants and refugees heading to the U.S. southern border. Trump tweeted that Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador were, quote, not able to do the job of stopping people from leaving their country and coming illegally to the U.S., and he claimed without any evidence that criminals and unknown Middle Easterners are mixed in with the Central Americans. One caravan member said they are not criminals.
Our message is we're not criminals. We're coming over here because we want to work. We need a job. We need better, you know, a better life. That's why we're here.
Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador received a combined total of more than $500 million in funding from the U.S. in the last fiscal year. It wasn't immediately clear how much Trump would seek to cut off. Today's the deadline to register to vote in next month's election. If you haven't received ballot materials, your registration may have lapsed or been canceled. You can check your status online and register at the website registertovote.ca.gov. Hurricane Willa has grown rapidly into an extremely dangerous near Category 5 storm in the eastern Pacific. It's on a path to smash into Mexico's western coast between Mazatlan and Puerto Vallarta by late tomorrow or early Wednesday. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, patchy morning fog and clouds, then sunny and breezy, highs in the mid-60s to lower 70s around the bay. In Fresno in the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny 78 to 83 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari, more news on 94.1 at 10 on Letters and Politics. Join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
KPFA and the New Parkway Theater are proud to present a special screening of the documentary The Long Shadow. This powerful film takes a candid look at America's original sin, slavery. Join us October 26th at 6 p.m. at the New Parkway Theater, 474 24th Street in Oakland, for The Long Shadow, a documentary that traces the history of slavery from the birth of this nation to racism today. This screening is a KPFA benefit.
KPFA has gone social. Media, that is. Stay connected to all things KPFA by visiting our Facebook and Twitter pages, where you'll be able to get special access to additional news and information from all of your favorite KPFA news and music programs. And make sure to check out KPFA's YouTube channel for never-seen-before musical performances and past KPFA author events. KPFA knows this is your station, and we want you to feel connected to us at all times so we can all continue to stay vigilant as always.
It is 8:35 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards Tiegert. There was a big court ruling earlier this month that rocked the world of Native American rights. A federal judge in North Texas struck down the portions of the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978 that give Native families preferential treatment when it comes to adopting Native American children. Now, that ruling currently does not extend to us here in California, but court watchers are warning that it's part of a legal assault and a long-term legal strategy that could impact most areas of Indian law. That would mean everything from casino rights to control over natural resources. Now, right this moment, we are having trouble getting through to the legal expert who we're hoping to discuss that with. So we're going to skip ahead to a segment about the actual conditions that the law was meant to address. When the Indian Child Welfare Act passed in 1978, it was a response to a legacy of forced assimilation efforts. In that year, one in four Native children, at a minimum, were living apart from their parents in boarding schools, in foster care, or in adoptive families. Here's a clip from the hearings that preceded the law's passage.
They went into my home and picked up my children and placed them in a foster home. And I think that they were abused in a foster home.
Well, my brother, he was mistreated by Mr. Kelly, and he slapped him, and he smoked right in his face and puffed right in the face, and he...
Well, Anna, just a minute, Anna. If you know, if that's too hard for you to talk about it now, you don't have to.
That is also a clip from our next guest's new documentary, telling that history of forced assimilation and following this country's first government-sanctioned truth and reconciliation process about it. It took place in Maine.
Where was the state? Where was the state that was supposed... They were supposed to have been our guardians. But where were they? They weren't there for us, but we didn't know. We knew nothing else but foster people. And how come it took so long for you all to get a group together to see if they can help us?
The film is Dawnland. Co-director Ben Pender Cudlip joins us now over Skype. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
How did you get started on this project?
Well, so my co-director, Adam Mazo, and I live in Massachusetts. And those of us in the Northeast don't often think about Maine and its connection to Massachusetts, but Maine used to be part of Massachusetts. Our co-director, Mishy Lesser, heard about the commission in its formative stages on a local public radio show, actually. We thought it was an opportunity to tell a story about genocide that has happened and is continuing to happen here at home.
So what was it like, you know, trying to get permission to take a film crew into an incredibly emotional and fraught storytelling process?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there are a lot of non-Native individuals, researchers, filmmakers who have gone into Native communities saying sort of the same things that we were saying. You know, trust us. We're here to tell your stories. We're here to, you know, here to try and do right by you and here to help. And so we were aware of that going in, and we spent about 8 months in conversation with the individuals that helped form the commission. Eventually, we were invited into the process, in part, I think, because of the strength of the work that my co-director, Adam Mazo, and our learning director, Michi Lesser, are doing with a project called the Upstander Project. It's an organization they founded that uses film as a teaching tool in classrooms all around the country to teach about genocide, human rights, bullying, othering. I think we were able to demonstrate that we're going to be able to use this film that we were working on to really do good all around the country and really make a difference.
You do a lot of history in the course of doing the film to bring in context. You kind of start the clock with the Indian boarding schools of the late 19th century. Could you kind of lay out what they were?
So the federal government passed a law which funded these boarding schools all around the country, and Native children as young as a few years old would be forcibly removed in some cases from their families. Indian agents occasionally withheld rations from families in order to encourage parents to send their kids to these boarding schools, where the children would learn how to, in the words of a person in our film, learn how to become white. They would have their hair cut. They would learn how to do trades. And the children would really, in some cases, they would be beaten if they spoke in their language. And so the schools were really a tool of continuing the genocidal practices that were founded with, were founded with the founding of this country. It's just sort of transformed into removing culture instead of just outright destruction of life.
And so the film presents the process of moving Native children through the child welfare system to the custody of Anglo families is basically a direct continuation of that program. What's the lineage?
Absolutely, yeah. So boarding schools were, started in the late 19th century and continued well into the 20th century. And then post-war, when the child welfare system was really becoming formalized, we would have largely non-Native social workers who saw it as a venue to take their cultural norms and put them onto Native families. So we would have, say, a non-Native social worker go into a house and say, there aren't enough windows here. This house is unfit for children. Or they'd see Native children playing outside without shoes on and it being muddy. And they'd say, this is your parents are not fit to be parents. They would have unwed mothers giving birth, and they would force them to sign over custody to their children before they were even born. There's testimony about this to the Senate in the hearings that led to the passage of the Indian Child Welfare Act. So the child welfare system really became a tool of assimilation, and through that became a tool of cultural destruction.
What did it do to the families who were split up?
I mean, it's an immense amount of trauma to be taken from your family and to grow up somewhere where, you've lost your culture, where you're not allowed to speak your language, where who you are is shamed and demeaned. And so the trauma, there's trauma for the children that were removed, but there's also trauma for the families who lost their children. Some individuals made it home later in life. Some never did. And so if you think about this happening at the scale of families, and then imagine at least one quarter of Native children in the 70s living outside of their homes, imagine what that does to entire communities losing their children. It's incredibly destructive, and that creates a trauma that's passed down from generation to generation, intergenerational trauma, and that's something that Native communities are still grappling with today.
I mean, what's striking about the film is that the federal government recognized that this was enough of a problem to specifically put a halt to it through law in 1978, but took no measures to address the damage that had already been done.
Yeah. It's, the testimony in those hearings it's really heart-wrenching. And the law itself is viewed as the gold standard for child welfare professionals, the idea of keeping a child with their family and with their culture, if at all possible. But you're absolutely right that there wasn't as much a lot of effort put into undoing those harms. And so that's one of the reasons that we found and are really compelled by the work of this Truth Commission, this Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Maine, and the Native and non-Native activists and community members whose work really led to it. We see it as a tool of a transformational tool of restorative justice and a really important method of healing that we would love to see replicated in whatever manner is appropriate in other areas of the country.
Tell me how the idea for a truth and reconciliation process got started.
In the late 90s, the government found the state of Maine out of compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act. And there were individuals working in the system, one of them, Esther Ann, who's in our film, who formed an organization intended to try to increase compliance. And as Esther talks about it, she says that they kept finding that they were coming up against this invisible wall with social workers not really understanding, especially some of the history, why this is so important, why it's so important to follow the Indian Child Welfare Act and keep Native kids with their families. So after well over a decade of work, this organization, which became the organization called Maine Wabanaki Reach, ended up being able to get the mandate for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission signed by the governor of Maine and by the five tribal chiefs. So it really is a grassroots, ground-up movement toward, in their words, truth, healing, and change.
What did that do for the people who experienced the trauma?
I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but we witnessed some really incredible moments of transformation and healing with many of the Native individuals that came forward to share their testimonies with the commission. People that didn't think they had a story to tell until they sat down with a commissioner or with a statement provider and started the talk and realized that no, assimilation and removal had impacted them, had impacted their family.
What do you think ultimately came of the truth and reconciliation process?
Well, I think in Maine specifically, there's a much higher level of awareness, both inside the system and outside the system and sort of the broader public, about child welfare, especially as it pertains to Native people. There certainly have been great strides made in the child welfare system in Maine, in terms of, in some cases, co-case managing cases with state child welfare and tribal child welfare. And the work of the commission, frankly, continues. The organization Maine Wabanaki Reach continues to do training sessions for child welfare professionals. They continue to work with non-Native folks, non-Native allies all across the state, and to teach about the history and why this is so important. And this type of understanding and acknowledgement of the history is even more important now because of the court's ruling, because of the jeopardy that the Indian Child Welfare Act faces.
All right. Ben Pender-Cudlip, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Ben Pender-Cudlip is co-director of the new documentary Dawnland, which is about the truth and reconciliation process taking place in the state of Maine to confront the history of using the child welfare system to separate Native American children from their families, their tribes, and their culture. It'll premiere on PBS on November 5th, but there is a special local screening today in Marin at noon in the Smith Raphael Film Center. Now moving on from the history to the present. The federal court case that dealt a blow to the Indian Child Welfare Act earlier this month was entitled Brackeen versus Zinke. The immediate facts of the case was the status of a 2-year-old Cherokee and Navajo boy who a white couple wanted to adopt and a Navajo family was also willing to adopt. The judge, Federal Judge Reed O'Connor, a Republican appointee, said that in this case, the Indian Child Welfare Act could not prevail and send the child to the Navajo family because he determined it was a quote-unquote race-based statute. As you're about to hear, this is an incredibly important distinction because defenders of Indian law say it is based on tribal membership and tribal sovereignty, not on race. If courts start adopting a race-based analysis, that could weaken much more than just rules for adoption of Native children. Joining us to go into that is Matthew Fletcher. He is a citizen of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, also director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thank you.
Why don't you start by explaining the legal consequences of interpreting this as a race-based law?
Well, if you take the court at its word in that all statutes that have the word Indian in them are subject to strict scrutiny, then pretty much everything in Title 25 of the U.S. Code is subject to attack. Possibly, other than the Indian Child Welfare Act, the first thing to go or to be seriously challenged is the Major Crimes Act, which authorizes the federal government to prosecute, quote, Indians in Indian country for federal crimes. So that includes more than just mere tribal members. It includes people who are Indian and meet some other criteria besides tribal membership. However, I think this case could be limited, not in a way that would be satisfactory to most tribes, but it could be limited to non-tribal members. So the court seems to be very concerned about Indian children who are not yet members of Indian tribes and saying that the act as applied to them should be construed under the strict scrutiny analysis. But for all others,
so the distinction here is between people who are eligible to be members of tribes but not enrolled as members of those tribes, and people who are enrolled as members of the tribes.
That's the easy distinction, yes. That would be the easier distinction.
Got it. Why is that an operative distinction for a two-year-old? It's not like they choose whether or not they're enrolled.
Well, it's a terrible distinction for a two-year-old. Let me give you my own family's example. My children are eligible for membership at several tribes here in Michigan, and my wife and I probably waited close to a year before we chose to enroll our children, our first child, in one of the tribes. And for anybody else to say that our child who is eligible at several different tribes was not an Indian person is really quite offensive. So, you know, there has to be a political relationship between Indian people who are not tribal members and certain tribes. Maybe it's just one, but there has to be that political relationship, even if they are not actually enrolled. It's sort of a false dichotomy.
So the interesting thing that put this case on our radar is that there were celebratory press releases about this federal court's decision from some really well-financed litigation shops, including the Goldwater Institute. Their principal patron are the Mercer families, who are also big backers of Donald Trump. And they filed an amicus brief in this case and apparently have been filing or joining cases like this targeting the Indian Child Welfare Act for years. What do they get? Why do they care about adoption rules for Native children?
That's a really good question. I wish I knew the answer. They'll tell you it's because they care about Indian kids, but those organizations have never done before anything to help Indian kids and are certainly not doing anything now. The comparison is, say, KC Family Programs, which dedicates an enormous amount of money to helping Indian families and actually all families avoid having their kids taken away through the foster care process and the foster care system. Goldwater and the other groups that are part of this have done absolutely zero for any children other than try to strip them from the protections of the Indian Child Welfare Act. My speculation is, to be frank, that quietly there's a recognition that the private adoption market is a $16 billion market. You can Google that. It's in the financial trade papers. It's a growing market. Just a few years ago, it was just $14 billion. Every adoption costs on average between $45,000 and $50,000 in fees that go to lawyers and adoption agencies. I'm not saying adoption is a terrible thing, and it's important to have that outlet. But the financial incentives to move a kid in foster care from foster care into the private adoption market are really enormous. And the private adoption entities and markets and representatives have been at the on the forefront of attacking the Indian Child Welfare Act since the legislative history, the years leading up to the enactment of the statute. It was the adoption agencies that did everything they could to stop ICWA, and I think that that's still happening.
ICWA is the Indian Child Welfare Act. Just say that for our listeners' right. benefit. I guess the other question I had is, if the court start tossing out areas of Indian law on the basis that they're race-based and not membership-based, does that precedent throw out, engage other really big financial interests? Like what about the natural gas and oil and mining resources that are managed on behalf of Native tribes?
Absolutely. There's a whole entire body of law, again, mostly in Title 25 of the U.S. Code, as I mentioned before, that relates to how Indian tribes have land, what we call trust land, land that's actually owned by the United States in trust for tribes, and that's federal land, but it's really reservation land. So tribes that own that land, they get to regulate the activities that occur on that land, including oil and gas, mineral extraction, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there has been a concerted effort over the last few decades to try to undo or limit that kind of land and to limit the acquisition of new trust lands, and also to undermine the statute itself, to say it's unconstitutional for the United States to acquire land and trust for Indian tribes. Now, if that's the case, and trust land isn't really trust land, it's just regular fee land, then that completely undermines Indian tribes and the federal government as its backer in terms of their ability to regulate on reservation, on trust land, oil and gas mineral extraction. And, you know, think about there's actually a case pending in the Supreme Court right now. It's a death penalty case out of Oklahoma. And the parties arrayed there will give you a sense of how this works. If the guy on death row wins, that means the state didn't have jurisdiction over this on reservation land. And it also means that the oil and gas industry that on Oklahoma that is doing work and business on reservation land within the reservation boundaries, but not on trust land, they will have to be regulated. They could be regulated by the federal government and the tribe. So oil and gas has enormous financial interests in rather having states regulate them rather than the federal government or Indian tribes, who tend to have much higher regulatory burdens imposed on natural resource extractors. The other place where this shows up is gaming. You know, Donald Trump had a lot of gaming interests over the years, and in the 90s and the aughties, so to speak. He was heavily involved in trying to limit tribal interests in Indian gaming on and off reservation. And there have been conservative organizations that have attacked the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act as being an unconstitutional race-based statute. And none of those have been successful yet either, but you can imagine how non-Indian entities and also state government entities interested in gaming would like to limit the scope of a statute like that.
And that's not just about competition with other non-Indian casinos. It's also about how much money from casino-owning tribes goes into Democratic coffers.
Yeah, that's obviously a very interesting point.
Matthew Fletcher, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Yep.
Matthew Fletcher is a citizen of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University. And that does it for today's show. Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and our guests at kpfa.org. If you want to get in touch, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org. Our producer is Corinne Smith, with help from Mira Nabulsi on today's show. Our engineer today, Rod Akeel. Hosts are me, Brian Edwards-Tiekert, and Antonia Juhas, Janine Etter most Fridays. A big thanks as well to our intern Justin Gold and to Mitch Jezerich and Eileen Alfandary for their contributions to the show. Stay up and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way in 2 minutes at 9 a.m.
exactly are the masters? Asks Noam Chomsky, adding that Peter Phillips' new book, Giants, The Global Power Elite, provides detailed, often shocking revelations about the astonishing concentration of private wealth and corporate power. It's a searing exposé of the 300 most powerful players in world capitalism. Peter Phillips' co-host on KPFA's Project Censored is Mickey Huff, now releasing Censored 2019. Together, Peter and Mickey will present their new books Tuesday evening, October 30th, 7:30, at First Congregational Church of Berkeley, 2345 Channing Way. This KPFA benefit has wheelchair access. Write it down now, October 30th. A formidable event with Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Find ticket information and much more about this on the KPFA website.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online worldwide at kpfa.org.
The time is 9 a.m. It's time for Democracy Now! Stay tuned.